stuck in when you can't get home.
People are still coming. I think we should have went.
They're still coming. Call here.
We're going to have to move our chair.
Can you open another one?
We could put a...
Move the front row back.
We have to open it up again.
Everyone. outside. That's where you plug in the speaker and come with it.
That little thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could run down to the center and ask for the speakers that go with the.
Wonderful if our historical society could draw this many people for most of their programs. We have in the past had a speaker to talk to us about the old days in Unalaska, Mr. Vern Robinson. Spoke to us about Unalaska in the days when he first came here, which was during the war. He was a U.S. Marshal here, and he had very interesting things to say. He did not prepare a speech, and we asked him questions, which was satisfactory. In fact, everyone was very happy with it. We do have that recording. It's available. Perhaps we will play it at the museum. We were running a little more on the ball over there. Also, Bill Dudikoff has given us a talk about Unalaska in the days when he was young. And there weren't any roads here, and there weren't any vehicles. It was very interesting. He also spoke of the days when the Aleuts were moved from Unalaska to southeastern Alaska and their return, and when the war was over. It was very interesting to get both sides of the same story. I know there are many, many interesting speakers here in Alaska that could talk to the Historical Society and give us some very, very fine information that will be gone when they are gone, unless we record it. And it would be marvelous to have these recordings for future generations in Unalaska. We need more members of the Historical Society, and we also need officers. We don't even have a secretary, so these proceedings are going unrecorded. Except by the recorder. So perhaps sometime in the near future, we will have an election of officers and get some really on the ball officers to run this organization. In all of the bays around Unalaska, there are many village sites, and every one of these village sites has artifacts. And these can be dug. They're supposed to be dug by anthropologists, carefully dug, according to the scientific way of uncovering things so that you know at what age something was put down there. Unfortunately, many of them have been burglarized, you might say, by people here or people who have come in here and just wanted something to carry back home. These will be lost also if we don't organize something. There are local buildings that are very, very archaic, you might say. They're well built and they don't leak. but they looked very bad. The Bishop's House I'm thinking of is one. Was a very beautiful building that was brought here from San Francisco. It was made of redwood. So it is not leaking. It is well built inside. But all of the windows are gone from it. And it looks terrible. We need to get it fixed up, replaced. Many of the things about it replaced. Right now, we need to cover the outside with some kind of covering, a paint or stain that will keep it from deteriorating. In a few years, if it's let go as it is now, it might be gone. Who knows? Well, there's much to be done in Unalaska in the Historical Society, and very few people have been doing it. In fact, we haven't been able to do it because there's not enough of it. Is that supposed to be speaking out there, too?
It will be every third of time.
Here comes Al Harper. Dr. Lawson has... Maybe he did. Maybe he's out the front trying to get in. Dr. Laughlin has with him several Russian anthropologists who are very eminent men in their field. And we're very, very fortunate to have him speak to us tonight. Simply because we're an interesting place to visit. We'll have to mention to Dr. Laughlin that retreat from KISS that comes on the television at 10 o'clock tonight. We'll all want to see that. Keep us from playing. That's a good idea. Can you do that? Keep the
emergency power fairy. Power fairy.
Wait.
Dr. Lawson, would you like to bring your friends up here too?
Oh yeah.
We have a place for them to sit.
I'm going to find a stand or something.
Commissioner Strybikoff, Larry Chapman, Sniewski, Rocky. Yes. Someone up here. Very nice.
Yes, please tell me.
We want the entire history. You got history here.
Please come up here. Time is flying. We thought perhaps Dr. Laughlin couldn't find the front door. But he is here now and everything is fine. Dr. Laughlin, the gentleman in the middle, he is a very noted anthropologist. No, that's you. And I'll turn it over to him right away as soon as I tell him that there is a very interesting television show going on at 10 o'clock that I'm sure we'd all like to watch.
All right. Well, I'll stop before 10 o'clock.
It's Retreat from Kiska. You might be interested in it yourself.
Retreat from Kiska?
Yes.
I think we all would be.
Very good. Okay. So, Dr. Lawson.
Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Eckhart. Real pleasure to introduce first my colleagues and from the Soviet Union who are here in the interest of all the people. We have the major staff of the Institute of History, Philology, and Philosophy of the Soviet Union from Novosibirsk, the Science City. And the head of the Institute is an academician, and that is academician Oklavnikov. The deputy director of the Institute is Dr. Deveryanko. The chief of section is Dr. Larichev. And the senior researcher is Dr. Vasilievsky. A longer version of Vasily, which is my name. And the translator and senior laboratory researcher is Mr. Sasha Konopatsa. And the agreements worked out between the governments of the United States and the Soviet Union, and between the Academy of Sciences of the Soviet Union and the National Academy of Our Sciences, and our State Department and their foreign ministry have made it possible for them to come for the first time in over 100 years and visit the Aleutian Islands and do research, because it's very important to both of our countries. Well, I will not have to do very much work this summer because we have five distinguished scientists to do the work. So next year I'll have more to say than I have tonight, but I will say something anyway to make it appear that we have done something worthwhile in the last few years.
Would you like to eat a piece of chocolate?
Well, there are three things that I want to talk about, and one is the origin of the Aleuts, and the second is why the Aleuts are so very important scientifically, and the third is why Aleuts and the Aleutian Islands are very important in the relations between the two largest countries in the world, the Soviet Union and the United States. So perhaps I can begin first by remarking on the origins of the Aleutian Islanders, and remark that all of the first Americans, as the Hugh Downs and the NBC is called them, the people who got here first, consisted of three kinds of people. First, there were Aleuts. Second, there were Eskimos. And third, there were Indians. And these are minor differences, but historically important. They're minor from the standpoint of citizenship. The next point is that all of them came from Siberia. And they came from Siberia when there was a large, dry bridge of land that connected Siberia and Alaska. So that had to be at least 10,000 years ago, and maybe 30,000 years ago. Somewhere between 10,000 years ago and 30,000 years ago, all of the first Americans came from Siberia. And the reason then that we want to collaborate and cooperate in our scientific research is because academician Plotnikov knows where the people came from, but until today, at 3 o'clock, he didn't know where they went to. and I know where they went to, but until next year, I won't know where they came from. So we have to exchange information, because only these two countries occupy the two sides of the Bering Sea. So we know that the first Americans migrated to Alaska at least 10,000 years ago, and maybe as much as 30,000 years ago. And they came across on the Bering Land Bridge. Now, it is my suggestion that the ancestors of the Aleuts and the Eskimos came across on the coast of the land bridge, on the southern coast, so that they had a marine economy. They adapted to the ocean. And they came around the southern coast, where they had first walrus, Worski, in the northern part, and then sea lions and hair seals, sea otters, and so forth. And they came around as far as Umnak Island. Now, Umnak Island turns out to be the most important island in the northern Pacific. And that is because that was the end of the southern extension of the Bering Land Bridge. The Bering Land Bridge, the edge of it went from somewhere on the south side of the Chukchi Peninsula of Siberia, and it included St. Lawrence Island, and it then came down and included the Pribilof Islands, and so it went something like this. Here was St. Lawrence Island, and then the St. Paul, which is a little bit interior at first, and St. George was a very holy country 30,000 years ago. Nothing but saints. Down to close to Port Muller. And then the edge of this bridge went out to Umnak, the Somalga Pass. Then from there up to there was 1,000 miles. Very large and very broad. This is Siberia. And so we think the people came around this way, this way, this way. And the further south they went, the better it got. It got warmer. There was less ice. And by the time they got out to here, to Somalga Pass, they got into what is called a big upwelling system. And this upwelling system, which has been studied by the Institute of Marine Sciences at the University of Alaska, is simply a system in which the water comes in from the Pacific Ocean, and it hits the edge of the continental shelf. It goes up like that. It goes up to the surface. And that mixes the water. So it gets more oxygen and more sunlight, and therefore there's more plankton, more zooplankton, more phytoplankton, more small things for the fish to eat. And then the small fish are eaten by the big fish, and the great big fish eat the small fish, and you have this enormous wealth. So Dr. Telly of Fairbanks noticed that out here around Kagamel, Chuganadak, Carlisle, and Uliaga, there were lots of birds, thousands and thousands of birds. And the only reason you can have so many birds, seabirds, is because the ocean was very rich. And then there were lots of whales. So the entire thing depends upon the nucleus. The chemicals, the biological nutrients coming in from the Pacific Ocean into the Bering Sea. But when they came through Somalga Pass, here at the end of Umnak, they hit the continental shelf, which is very solid, and turned up. And that took them up to the surface. So you had an extremely rich ecological zone. You had more birds, more fish, more sea mammals, and also the biggest sea mammal, the whale, in this area here. So we think that the ancestors of the Aleuts, and we don't know whether to call them Aleuts or ancestors of the Unangan, Tunun, they came here, they came to an island which is, let me write it in Cyrillic, which everybody either reads or they ought to read. And it's Anan Wola. They came to this island at the end of the Bering land bridge, which is the northwestern arm of Nikolsky Bay on Umnak Island. And that was then a part of the island. So it was a very rich place to live. And people could stay there and live the year around. And the reason they could live the year around is because they had those things which grew on the strand flats. And those are the sea urchins. The sea urchin is perhaps the most important animal in the Aleutian Islands. Very nutritious. And they could collect them a large part of the year, and women could collect them, and children could collect them, as well as men. So this may have been the beginning of women's liberation. And then they got the Bidarkies, the chitons, and their clams and other things. And another very important one was Ilogao, which is also known as octopus. So these things then came off of the strand flats or the reefs. That's one. Two, they got lots of fish. And there were four kinds of salmon. And there were halibut and cod and then pogi, greenies, and so forth. But a large number of fish. And they got these a large part of the year. They could get halibut during the winter or something. And thirdly, got lots of birds. And the important thing in the economy of the birds is the fact that they got the bird himself. They ate him. They also, they got the bird and they got the eggs. And then there are various kinds of birds like eider ducks, common eiders. You take some eggs away, they will lay some more. So they increase the egg production by collecting them. So they got the eggs of eiders, and eggs of puffins, tufted puffins and horned puffins, and seagulls and all the rest. That's very important, and these can be preserved. And that helped them survive the early part of the winter a great deal. And then they had everything from albatross. We have found in the excavations three species of albatross. And there's the sooty-footed albatross, and there's the Asiatic albatross, and there's another one whose name I've now forgotten. But all three species were being used by the very early Aleuts. And that's a large seabird. And at the other end is a little tufted puffin who doesn't even know how to fly. He just flops down in the water. So they have all kinds of birds. Then the fourth big food source were the sea mammals. And as everybody knows very well, the smallest one was Chinato. The sea otter, and a very valuable one. And then the biggest one, of course, was the blue whale. There were several kinds of whales, but the smallest sea mammal in the world is the sea otter. He's also the most clever. He knows how to make tools, and he's very smart. He waves at people. And if there's anything that human beings like, they like to have animals wave at them. way back. Well, the sea otter is perhaps the most famous and the most valuable kelp, of course, in the world, and it's a very social animal. It's also very clever because he knows how to make his living lying on his back. He lies there with his sea urchin and breaks them up. So then it's obvious that the early Aleuts who came to Angola, and we know at least 8,700 years ago, but before the present, and we know that they lived on this little island for some 900, maybe 1,000 years. And so from 8,700 to 7,800 years ago, and we have then a very fine record of the stone tools that they used and of a fairly complex culture. Now, an interesting thing that we didn't know before we started our work is that in order to live in an area like the Aleutian Islands, which is basically rich, it's also very difficult. It's very harsh and very stressful. And the people have to have a complex culture. They have to have several kinds of fish hooks and several kinds of harpoons. And they have to have boats, and they have to have lamps, and several other things. You can't live in the Aleutian Islands like you do in South Dakota or Chicago, just walk out and stay alive. So when they came in, they already had a complex culture. And that must have started much earlier up here, very likely back in Siberia. Second thing that we know, which is very interesting, is that in Angola, the place where the people lived, which is, by the way, called Igoxelo, the place of the blade, Igabe. The Aleuts knew about this a long time ago. It's only 33 feet above the sea. It's 33 feet high. It's right on the coast. That's the only major site on the entire Bering Sea. That's right on the coast. So we know they had a marine economy and they were living from marine resources. Now there's a very important site on the Kamchatka Peninsula that the Russians have excavated very well and very thoroughly. And that's Ushki, Lake Ushki. But it's in the interior. And so this is the only one that's right on the ocean. In fact, it's so close to the ocean that when the tide is coming in and there's a storm, you get wet from the spray. So this is a real coastal site. Well, then they had all these resources. We have these resources because of the geomorphology. And now we are finding then thousands of stone tools. They're sort of dull, uninteresting tools. And a lot of them just look call them blades, or regatta. They look like this, maybe 15 centimeters, maybe 4 inches in length, and they have a ridge down the back. In cross section, they look like this. It's curved that way, this is curved that way. And interestingly, they only chip them here on the surface, on one surface, and on the edge. Never clear across. Now, Dr. Vasilievsky has found a site at Imchin in Sakhalin, which is very similar. But the chipping goes clear across the surface. So it's very similar, but there are some differences. So we know that the parallels and the origins are in Siberia, but we don't yet have enough information to know how long ago or all the changes that have taken place. Another thing we know is that 8,700 years ago, these people were making lamps. They were making good oil lamps. And secondly, and distinct from the lamps, they were making stone dishes. And these stone dishes have thin walls, carved carved stone dishes. The Eskimos never made these stone dishes. That's something very unique. We know that they were making, of course, they had line sinkers and net weights, so they were doing a lot of fishing. And then they also had a braiders for shaping the shafts of arrows of spear. These were made out of lava. And then another interesting thing, they had an image of the deity, Kavagada. And if I can recall how to spell, this shows both the art and the religion. And he was called Kavagada. This is a small figure of the deity. And this is Kava, which is a deity, a god. And then this is the diminutive, which means it's a small one. And in every case, these would have the eyes and the nose and mouth. But interesting, around the head, when you look at them from the side, they have a girdle. And they have one that went this way, around this way, so they could be hung from the ceiling beam of a house. And then they were honored, they were placed in an important place and protected. But this began 8,700 years ago or earlier. So we see there are a lot of continuities, a lot of traits in the old Aleut culture that have persisted up to after the time that we bought Alaska, 1867 or 1898, sometimes a little bit later. And this is one of the very important traits. So we know the culture then had the lamps, the stone dishes, and the net weights, and the shaft scrapers, and the image of the deity, which also illustrates a very fine art style. People very early learned to make their art forms with just a minimum of carving, and it's done very skillfully. Well, these people lived there quite successfully. One other thing that I should mention, and that is that a lot of the 20%, one-fifth, of the stone tools are made of obsidian, the black volcanic glass obsidian. And in Aleut, this is called chaga. Chaga. And some years ago, a linguist, Gordon Marsh, and I were working on the south end of Umnak Island at Nikolsky, and out on Rabbit Island, Anangot. And the geologist, who's been very helpful in cooperating, Dr. Hopkins and Byers and others, and they wrote us a letter, and they said they had found a place on the north end of Umnak Island where they had found obsidian. It was a large dome, 100 feet long, 10 feet broad, and they sent us a map. They said, this is the only known source of obsidian in the Aleutian Islands. And they said, and the nearest place on the map is called Chaga. So we wrote back and said, that's just the right place to find obsidian, because Chaga is the name for obsidian. So we know where it comes from on the north end of Umnak Island, and it comes from the Cape Chaga. Well, what this means then is that there were people living 70 miles north of Anangola. And there must have been several settlements going on back toward Port Miller. But what happened geologically is that as the Wisconsin Glacier melted and the sea level became higher, then the land bridge was gradually submerged, it was inundated. And the only places that survived were parts of islands like St. Lawrence, high parts of it, and St. Paul, and St. George. And then the eastern Aleutian Islands was cut into passes. And so you had the pass between Umnak and Unalaska, and between Unalaska and Akun, Akutan, Akutan and Akun, and so forth. And you've got 25 islands here where it had been dry land before. So the interesting thing then about the Aleuts is that the Aleuts got to the Aleutian Islands before they were Aleutian Islands. And while they were living there, the peninsula was dissolved into a series of 25 or more islands. So there's a lot of time involved and a great many changes. On the other hand, the changes were very dramatic from the appearance. If you change from a peninsula to islands, you have a big difference. But the early ancestral Aleuts lived on the coastline. And the more coastline they had, the better off they were. So when they cut up the peninsula into islands, it's like a real estate dealer, an honest real estate dealer, who subdivides, see, and you get more coastline, and therefore there could be more Aleuts. Then the population increased. So when the sea level rose, the land bridges submerged, and the old peninsula was cut into islands, then we got an increase in population. So the time Vitus Bering and Steller and Sternberg and all the others discovered the Aleutian Islands, there were at least 16,000 Aleuts living, because it was a very rich environment, number one. Number two, the people knew how to exploit it. They had all the different kinds of boats, the Ikiyotik, the Uluktok, the Uluktuluk, so forth. And they had all the different kinds of spears, arrows, and lamps, and dishes, and everything from drums to deities. So, and the very, very nice clothing, good rain gear, good warm clothing, bird skin parkas, and so forth. So with their system of exploitation, with their control of the economy, plus a very rich economy, then they came out with a very, very large population, 16,000. So what we have then is a very interesting situation in which the Aleutian Islanders, one single people with one language, three dialects, but they could all understand each other, even though they didn't want to admit it. The Sasean, the Choa Lingan, and so forth, like to ridicule each other's language, but they can hear them first and then do the ridicule. So they had one language with three important dialects.